Now, we're going to move rather rapidly for a couple of chapters in Joshua, as what we get is another long list of towns and cities and boundaries that describe the territories of each of the tribes of Israel. Now, this is given to us in words because map making was only in its most primitive stages in this era. And by all accounts, the Hebrews did not yet engage in drawing maps on papyrus or animal hides. However, for us, it's easier to see Israel's tribal boundaries on a modern map than to try to visually put together this word puzzle picture that we read in Joshua 18 and 19. Even so, a map can give us a very wrong impression of reality of those times if we don't grasp that while overall boundaries were given for each territory, in fact, only certain cities and villages within that territory actually came under the control or use of the particular tribe to which the lot had assigned it. A more accurate map would look more something like the measles or the chicken pox. All right, just little clusters of spots, all right, with vacant areas in between them. The spots would represent the actual areas under Israeli control, the vacant areas either under enemy control or it's just simply kind of a no man's land. Now, another problem for us and even for the best biblical scholars is that many, if not most, of the places used to describe each territory are presently not identifiable with much certainty. Just like in the U.S., where no city or town has a patent on its own name, and thus anywhere from several to scores of other cities and towns bears exactly the same name. It was like that within the land of Canaan. We're going to find several Bethels, at least three known Gilgals, many Kadeshes, all right, and so on. And some of these places are pretty easy to discern. Others we have pretty good hints because later names in different languages of that same place are obvious attempts to vocalize the Hebrew town name into another language, usually into Aramaic or even Arabic. Still others are completely just lost to history. Therefore, even our current maps are just the best possible educated guesses and estimations from whatever the highest current level of scholarship might be. Now, we ended last time by finding out that the seat of government for Israel was moved from Gilgal, which was in an as yet unassigned territory, to Shiloh in Hebrew, Shiloh, and the newly assigned territory of Ephraim. There, the wilderness tabernacle, or actually what remained of it, was erected, and the priesthood officiated over the sacrificial rituals there at Shiloh. Now, Shiloh is where Joshua ruled from. Shiloh was his headquarters. And Shiloh would remain the capital of the 12 tribes until the time of Eli, all right, from the book of Samuel. So that means it was the capital, if you would, of the Israel territories for about three centuries. Now, the rabbi Rashi says that the sacred tent took an entire other form when it was moved to Shiloh. It had no roof, but it did have a stone floor. And further, the tent doubled as both a sanctuary, but also as housing for Joshua and his predecessors. Thus, it was called by a number of names, including the tent, the house of the Lord, even the tent of Joseph, altering this area. Now, I can't say if Rashi is necessarily correct, but with the tribes that are now dispersed all over the promised land of Canaan, each mostly concerned with day-to-day life and its own tribal affairs and well-being, you know, it's really just not very hard to imagine that the magnificent tent structure that took so much effort, so many people to construct it in the first place, back under Mount Sinai, that now it would be pretty neglected and worn out. By all accounts, when David got his hands on the Ark of the Covenant about 1000 BC, he placed it in just an ordinary tent. Why didn't he simply order the Wilderness Tabernacle to be moved to his headquarters? Why don't we hear of great protests by the priests and the Levites about this greatest of sacred objects, the Ark, that's in Israel's possession, being moved around by common Israelites and put into the possession of a Judean king instead of under the watchful eye of a Levite high priest? Almost certainly because the Wilderness Tabernacle was just a ramshackle by now. The magnificent curtains and coverings would have long ago worn out and apparently were replaced by quick and easier coverings, or they just weren't even replaced at all. The priesthood was not functioning as it should. And with the advent of the office of king, beginning first with Saul, then David, priestly influence and authority was greatly weakened. In fact, it should not take a lot of imagination to see that with the establishment of a king now over Israel, it was going to take some time of wrestling for position between the priesthood and the royal office of king to kind of figure out some kind of an acceptable government structure that divided up duties and authority between them in a new way. Not that this was what God had intended. He hadn't ordained this for Israel. But it was simply what happens when mankind starts tinkering with God's plans to make them better fit our plans. And it's what happens when we beseech the Lord to allow us to have our way, which he will do at times, and which he did do in Israel's want of a king. But you know what we usually find out? The results aren't so hot. Then things don't usually turn out so well. Well, let's begin today by reading Joshua 18, but we're going to start at verse 11. Joshua 18, starting at verse 11. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 261. The lot for the tribe of the descendants of Benjamin, came up according to their families. The border of their territory was chosen by lot, and it was between the descendants of Judah and the descendants of Joseph. On the north side, the border began at the Jordan. It went up alongside Jericho on the north, continued up through the hills westward, arrived at the Beit Avon Desert. And from there, the border passed on to Luz, to the south side of Luz, that is Beit El. And then the border went down to Atrot Adar, by the hill on the south side of the lower Beit Horon. The border was delineated as turning at the western corner and heading southward from the hill located in front of Beit Horon on the south. It ended at Kiryat Baal, that is Kiryat Yarim, a city belonging to the descendants of Judah. This was the west side. On south, the border extended westward from the most distant part of Kiryat Yarim, going out to the source of the Nephtaoch spring. Then the border went down to the farthest part of the hill located in front of the Beit Ben Hinnom Valley, north of the Rephaim Valley, south of the Jebusites, and continued down to Ein Rogel, where it was drawn to the north. Then it went on to Ein Shemesh, continued to Gliot, which is across from Maale Adumim, and then went down to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben, passed alongside the Arabah, heading north, went down to the Arabah. Then the border passed alongside Beit Hogla, heading north, and the border ended at the north bay of the Dead Sea and the south end of the Jordan. This was the southern border. The Jordan was to be its border on the east side. This was the inheritance of the descendants of Benjamin, defined by its surrounding borders according to their families. The cities of the tribe of the descendants of Benjamin, according to their families, were Jericho, Beit Hogla, Amek, Ketzitzit, Beit Arba, Zamaraim, Beit El, Avim, Parah, Ophrah, Kfar Har Amona, Ophni, and Geva, 12 cities, together with their villages. Givon, Ramah, Beeroth, Mitzpah, Kephrah, Motzah, Rechem, Yerpiel, Tar Allah, Tselah, Eleph, Yavusi, that is Jerusalem, Givat and Kiryat, 14 cities along with their villages. This is the inheritance of the descendants of Benjamin according to their families. Now, the verses just preceding those told us that Joshua got fed up with waiting for the remaining seven tribes who had yet to claim their land portion to get on the stick and accept it and finish conquering it. So he ordered that each tribe put forth three men as tribal representatives, giving them a total of 21 men, who would act as a team. And they would go to the general area that had been determined for their particular tribe by the lots that Moses drew for them some years earlier. And they were to go and then describe, it says, that area. Basically, that means they were to reconnoiter it. And they were to record the existing cities and villages and major landmarks and geographical features in detail, bring it all back so that the leadership could make some decisions about fitting each of the seven tribes into a more precise amount of space to better accommodate the current population. And this was aided by Joshua and the high priest Eleazar going before the Lord using lots. Going before the Lord, that term means that something takes place at the tabernacle. And we're going to see that phrase used in both the Old and New Testaments. Now notice how many times lots were drawn by now. How much elasticity there was to the territorial assignments depending on the most current conditions. And as we move along towards the end of the book of Joshua, and then immediately into the book of Judges, we're going to see that the territories of each of the tribes expanded or contracted or moved, sometimes even disappeared. So all we can ever do to understand where a given tribal territory for a given tribe lay is to take a snapshot in time, because this was not a static thing. It changed, it evolved. Now, after the foray of those 21 men, three members from each of seven tribes, the lots were drawn, and the first lot that came out was for Benjamin. Now, note that the phrase in verse 11 that it was divided up according to their families is an important one. In other words, while we tend to think of the territory of Benjamin as just one monolithic hunk of land, that's not how it was thought of then. Rather, families, clans, were given cities, sometimes associated villages, and they existed in a generally recognized area that, when it's all added together, could roughly be called the territory of Benjamin. The area set aside for the several clans of Benjamin lay in between the areas of Ephraim and Judah, and it acted a lot like a buffer zone between these two very powerful tribes. Now, although it's not a large area, it is prestigious because it contained Jericho and Jebus. Jebus, of course, would eventually be captured by David, and he would rename it the City of David. And then later on, it would be known as Jerusalem. By all rights, Benjamin was the last born son of Jacob, and traditionally, should have received the least status of all the brothers, of all the tribes. But being the first drawn of the lots for these final seven tribes, and then given the position of having their borders contiguous with both the Joseph and the Judah tribes, indicated a much higher than expected status in the Israel hierarchy. This elevated status was thoroughly understood by all the tribes of Israel, and it was going to play a very significant role in Israel's future. The next tribal allotment went to Simeon. And we're going to find this event in the opening verses of Joshua chapter 19. So let's read Joshua chapter 19. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 261. The second lot came out for Shimon, Simeon, for the tribe of the descendants of Shimon, according to their families. Their inheritance was inside the inheritance of the descendants of Judah. For their inheritance, they had Beersheba, Sheva, Moladah, Hatzar Shual, Bala, Etzim, El Tolad, Betuel, Hormah, Ziklag, Beit Markavot, Hatzar Susa, Beit Labaoth, and Sharuchen, 13 cities together with their villages. Ain, Rimon, Eter, and Ashan, 4 cities together with their villages, and all the villages surrounding these cities as far as Baalat Be'er, Ramah of the Negev. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Shimon, according to their families. The inheritance of the descendants of Shimon was taken out of the allotment for the descendants of Judah because the portion given to the descendants of Judah was too much for them. So the descendants of Shimon had an inheritance inside the descendants of Judah. Now the third lot came up for the descendants of Zebulun according to their families. And the border of their inheritance began at Sarid. And then their border went up westward to Mar-Alah, extended to Dabasheth, and on to the Wadi fronting Yokneam. Also from Sarid, it turned towards the sunrise to the east, to the border of Kisalot Tavar, went on to Dovrat, and up to Yafya. And from there it passed eastward to Gat Hefer, on to Et Katzin, went out to Rimon, and reached to Neah. Then the border turned on the north side to Hanaton, ending in the Yiftachel Valley, also Katat, Nahalal, Shimron, Yid Allah, and Beit Lechem, Bethlehem, 12 cities together with their villages. This is the inheritance of the descendants of Zebulun according to their families, these cities with their villages. The fourth lot came out for Issachar, for the descendants of Issachar according to their families. Their territory included the Jezreel, Keslot, Shunem, Hafaraim, Shion, Anacharat, Ravit, Kishon, Evetz, Remet, Ein Ganim, Ein Hadah, and Beit Patzetz. This, their territory extended to Tabor, Shachatzitma, and Bet Shemesh, and their territory ended at the Jordan, 16 cities together with their villages. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Issachar, according to their families, the cities with their villages. The fifth lot came out for the tribe of the descendants of Asher, according to their families. Their territory included Helkat, Hali, Beten, Akshaf, Alamelech, Amad, and Mishal. It extended to the Carmel on the west and to Shechor Libnat. The border turned eastward to Beit Dagon, reached to Zebulun, and the Yiftachel Valley on its north, then Beit Emech And Ne'el went out to Kavul on the left, then Evron, Rehov, Haman, Cana, and on to the greater Sidon. The border turned towards Ramah and the fortified city of Tzor. Next, the border turned to Hosnah and extended at the sea from Havel to Aksiv. Also included were Umah, Aphek, and Rehov, 20 cities together with their villages. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Asher, according to their families, these cities with their villages. The sixth lot came out for the descendants of Naphtali, according to their families. Their border went from Heleph and the oak in Za'ananim. It included Adami Nechev and Yavnel and went on to Lakum and ended at the Jordan. Westward, the border turned to Aznot Tabor and went out from there to Hukok, reaching to Zebulun on the south, Asher on the west, Judah at the Jordan on the east. The fortified cities were Tzidim, Tzer, Hamat, Rakat, Kinneret, Adamah, Ramah, Hatzor, Kedesh, Edrei, Ein Hatzor, Yuron, Megdel El, Horim, Beit Anat, and Beit Shemesh, 19 cities together with their villages. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Naphtali, according to their families, the cities with their villages. The seventh lot came out for the tribe of the descendants of Dan, according to their families. The territory of their inheritance included Tzorah, Eshtaol, Irshemesh, Shalbin, Ayalon, Yitla, Ayalon, Timna, Echron, Eltke, Gibton, Beelat, Yehud, Benai Barach, Gat Ramon, Yarkon Springs, and Rakon with the border fronting Jaffa. The territory of the descendants of Dan was too small for them. So the descendants of Dan went up and fought against Lashem, captured it, defeated it by the sword, took possession of it and lived there, calling Lashem Dan, after Dan their ancestor. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Dan, according to their families, these cities with their villages. When they had finished distributing the land for inheritance according to its borders, the people of Israel gave an inheritance with their territory to Joshua, the son of Nun. According to Adonai's order, they gave him the city he had asked for, Timnath Serach, in the hills of Ephraim. So he built up the city and he lived in it. These are the inheritances of Eleazar the Kohen, the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the leaders of the ancestral clans of the tribes of the people of Israel, distributed for inheritance by lot in Shiloh, before Adonai at the door of the tent of meeting. Thus they finished dividing up the land. Yay, right? It's going to be a test on this, okay? Now, Simeon, Shimon, is a very interesting case, I think. They were given territory within the territory of Judah. Now, while Judah would certainly have been unhappy with giving up some of its territory to Simeon, in reality, this was more of a slap in the face to Simeon. That's how it was meant. Surrounded completely by Judah, put Simeon, Shimon, in a totally dependent situation. Essentially, this was the fulfillment of a curse that was pronounced upon Simeon by his own father, Jacob. Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 49. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 56. Genesis chapter 49. We're just going to read the first seven verses for you to recall this. Genesis 49, starting at verse 1. Then Yaakov, Jacob, called for his sons, and he said, "Gather yourselves together, and I will tell you what will happen to you in the Achrit Hayamim, the world to come. Assemble yourselves and listen, sons of Jacob. Pay attention to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my strength, the first fruits of my manhood. Though superior in vigor and power, you are unstable as water. So your superiority will end because you climbed into your father's bed and defiled it. He climbed onto my concubine's couch. Shimon, Simeon, and Levi, are brothers, related by weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let my honor not be connected with their people. For in their anger, they killed men. At their whim, they maimed cattle. Cursed be their anger, for it's been fierce. Their fury, it's been cruel. I will divide them in Jacob. I will scatter them in Israel." Here we see that Levi and Shimon, Levi and Simeon, as we usually say, were lumped together. They were given essentially the same cursed future. They would be divided and scattered within the promised land. Yet the way this came about for those two tribes was quite different. Levi went on to become the most prestigious tribe, the priestly tribe. In fact, they were elevated in such a way that they were not even to be considered a tribe of Israel any longer. They were actually separated, divided away. They would be set apart. Some might even say set above, for full-time service to Yehovah on Israel's behalf. Interestingly, the scattering prophecy for Levi was fulfilled in that they received 48 cities, along with a meager amount of pasture land immediately outside each of those cities. And these 48 cities were not close together. They weren't connected in such a way as to form a territory of Levi. Rather, they were dispersed all over Israel, all over the promised land, among all the tribal territories. And while the cities were technically owned by the Levites, in another sense, they were only permitted to live there and control that particular city at the consent of the local tribe. Now, Simeon, on the other hand, was not scattered in the same way. At first glance, there appears to be no scattering at all. But notice something about the description of the area they were given. There's no described borders to it. No borders are described for Simeon. Rather, there's just a list of cities and villages given to them. Remember about the measles and the chicken pox? Okay. Although they were all located in a fairly concentrated area within Judah's territory, nonetheless, it was going to wind up being a very weak confederation of cities that caused Simeon to decrease steadily in power and in population. So the tribe went into a steady decline over the centuries, and eventually there was no territory of Simeon. In fact, we know that some of the clans of Simeon moved north, and they became absorbed into the various tribes of what in time would be known as the Northern Kingdom. We think of the Northern Kingdom as the 10 lost tribes. Now, other clans and individual families threw their allegiance to Judah, others yet to Benjamin. So indeed, Jacob's curse on Simeon played out by them ultimately being divided up among all the other tribes of Israel for the most part. Now, we'll move a little quicker now. The third lot fell out for Zebulun, and its territory was up north at the northern end of the Jezreel Valley. So Zebulun had some very good, fertile territory at its disposal. Notice how the description of Zebulun again involves boundary lines, not just a list of cities or villages. The fourth lot was for Issachar, and Issachar is described by both cities and boundary lines. It too is far to the north in Canaan. The fifth lot described the territory of Asher. Notice verse 31 that is common to each of the pronouncements of each of the tribal territories, that the territory was given according to families, as opposed to just being given over to the tribal prince to own, and then allow the families to use it as his pleasure. The clans and the families all belong to a tribe, but the tribal leader is not a king, who by definition owns everything in the land over which he reigns. It's not how it worked. Therefore, the city or the village given to a clan is owned by that clan and is not but a temporary assignment that their tribal chief can invalidate at his will. Now, Asher received some strategically important and valuable territory because it included the Mediterranean seacoast. So it afforded them an opportunity to build ports and engage in the accompanying trade business. Of course, there was one little problem. Joshua had conquered none of the seacoast. So it was going to be up to Asher to figure out how to take it away from its current inhabitants. Naphtali received the sixth lot, and his territory was located between Asher and the upper Jordan River region. It went well to the north, the northernmost boundary of what would have been at that time thought of as Canaan. And on its southern border lay Zebulun and then Issachar. And later this region would actually be called the Galilee. We know it better as the Galilee. The tribe of Dan received the seventh and final lot, a sure sign, by the way, of its status in the eyes of the Lord. As quickly as the territory is described to us, we are told in verse 47, territory was not large enough for them. And this fits well with the earlier censuses that showed that Dan was actually among the larger tribes of Israel. Therefore, they looked for more territory. So they went far to the north in Canaan. They conquered a place called Leshem and changed its name to Dan. Now, Dan was in tough right away, and they must have known it. Judah was forced to give up some of its westernmost towns. Ephraim lost some of its southernmost towns in order to form the territory of Dan. Neither of the two most prestigious tribes of Israel would have liked that very much. And worse, the major unspoken-for area that Dan was given was the central and southern Mediterranean seacoast, and the problem with that is it was currently occupied by the fierce, formidable, and technically advanced sea peoples that are later on called the Philistines. And much of the tribe of Dan elected to switch rather than fight. And so this accounts for the interest of many of Dan's clans in just packing up and moving well north to what they saw was better prospects. Well, the capturing of the northern city of Leshem probably seemed like a great accomplishment for Dan, but it turned out to be a pretty slippery slope. Pagans surrounded them, and Dan quickly adopted their ways. The northern city and territory of Dan became a center of Israelite idolatry, and even calf worship was mixed in with the worship of the God of Israel. Now, you can visit that area, by the way, to this day. Beautiful spot. Gorgeous up there. And see the capital city of Dan. Still there. But you can also see the paganism. And it's really a sad thing. Thus, we'll see mention of Dan in the Bible reduced to near nothing over time, except when it involved invoking a curse. And Dan won't re-enter Israel's wonderful prophetic future until late in the prophetic process. Well, in verse 49, Joshua finally receives his reward of an inheritance of land within the tribal boundaries of Ephraim. Why Ephraim? When Joshua has been the head of all Israel for many years, because he's from the tribe of Ephraim and represents a powerful Ephraimite clan. And these tribal and clan links are deeply ingrained in Hebrew society. And it's noteworthy that the section of the book of Joshua concerning the dividing up of the promised land begins with one of the two scouts, Caleb, that came back with that good report about the land of Canaan while Israel, remember, while they were still out in the wilderness. So he got the first inheritance of land that was given within the promised land. And the section ends with the other scout, who's Joshua himself, getting his inheritance, but only after all the other tribes have received theirs. Now, there's a couple of important principles being demonstrated in this entire arrangement. And first and most important is that God completed exactly what he said he'd do. And what he'd do is give Israel a land of its own. Second of all is that Joshua did all that the Lord commanded of him. Joshua was obedient. He was a model leader for Israel to follow in the future. The verses on this subject were written in such a way as to neither glorify the land given to Joshua as special or as the best of all the promised land, nor was it to glorify the leader of Israel, Joshua. Rather, it was to draw attention to the holy God of Israel, who always keeps his word. Even though centuries may pass when it seems like God must have changed his mind, when earthly circumstances appear to have passed by any hope that what God said he'd do, that it even makes any sense in the present reality. Although men have given up and fallen away from God, what he said would happen will happen. Always. But what else is called for is repentance and renewal within both the Jewish and Christian communities to abandon doctrines that were long ago established under the premise that God has forgotten his promises or perhaps has changed his mind. Put plainly, men have decided that God is either not faithful or not able to do what he said he'd do. I mean, how much we read, particularly the older testament of the Bible, and sometimes we shake our heads in disgust at those faithless Israelites who committed idolatry, who joined themselves with the world, who mixed a little of this and a whole lot of that to form a religion that's not very recognizable from a scriptural viewpoint, and who abandoned the principles of God in favor of some new and more comfortable humanistic philosophies. Yet in most respects, has the church done that much better? I've often said that the Judaism of Christ's era and the Christianity of our era look like two rails of a train track. I mean, they're separated by doctrines, but they follow exactly the same path, starting and ending at the same places. Where they began was purity. Where we've ended up is pollution. See, here's the thing. Here's the thing that we must see for our time. A large segment of our Jewish and Gentile brothers and sisters in the faith believe it is time to solve the Middle Eastern and Israel problem by doing the one thing that God says must not be done. Give up the land that he set apart for his people. Land that we are watching Joshua's people fight for, and it should be given up to people who have no spiritual right to it. Many Jews and Christians see things as so radically changed from the time when the scriptures were written that they think that certainly we would be ignorant bumpkins to still believe that its instructions and prophecies remain valid in the 21st century. And one of the reasons they believe this is because with all their hearts, they are certain that with the birth of Christ, the Lord threw the Bible away and wrote a new one that we call the New Testament. I'm encouraged that you who are listening to this either already understand that no such thing took place, or at least are reconsidering this long-held but erroneous belief. Okay, let us determine together to return to our faith roots as best we can, with the direction and power of the Lord as our compass and our sail, even if it means that our friends and families pull away from us because we're not following the crowd. As I've said to many folks, I want you to really think hard about this. If the Lord can throw his promises away in past times, why won't he do it again in the future? But I'm not concerned about it, because he didn't throw away his promises, and he won't ever. Well, let's move on now to Joshua chapter 20, which we'll read next week. But before we do that, I want you to get the gist of this chapter. Now that the land has been subdued, notice I did not say conquered, just subdued, and the tribes have been allotted all their territories, Jehovah instructs Joshua that it's time for the tribes to set aside that network of cities that will become known as the Levitical cities, and some that will become the cities of refuge, also called sanctuary cities. There were going to be 48 cities set aside for the Levites to live in. This was not to be a mixed population. It was to be for Levites only. However, no doubt some foreigners and probably some other Israelites lived there, if there was maybe a specific purpose or reason for them being there. Now, out of these 48 cities, six of them were to be designated as sanctuary cities, cities of refuge, three on the west side of the Jordan, three on the east side. And there was also a provision for three more cities of refuge to be established if Israel spread out and conquered more territory and needed extra sites of refuge. Now, these special cities were to be strategically spread out in the Promised Land and in the Transjordan so that a person who needed what they offered could get there pretty rapidly. And the instructions for cities of refuge were laid out while Moses was still in charge, when the Israelites were still on their wilderness journey. So the first few verses of Joshua 20 are actually a repeat of Numbers 35, verses 9 through 29. Now, we're too short on time to read these verses this week. We will next time. Now, I am really fascinated with this concept of the cities of refuge. Most scholars see this simply as an ancient way of handling a situation of accidental or unintentional manslaying. Before there was a strong central government or a police force to deal with it. So the Hebrews just merely adopted the same concept. Now, while there's an element of truth to that, I see something considerably deeper. I see a parallel with an obscure and mysterious place that the Bible calls Abraham's bosom. Abraham's bosom. You know, an often asked question in the church is, what happened to the righteous that died before the advent of Christ? What happened to those people? And while I readily admit I can't be 100% certain of the answer, I believe the established God patterns are our best guide to know. It was much the same then as happens today, but with a noticeable difference, the advent of Yeshua. When a person dies today, their spirit or their soul is released from its corpse and immediately goes to one of two places, heaven or hell. So there's a kind of a judgment, or perhaps better, a determination by the Lord that happens immediately upon our death in our era, but that's just as it was in Bible times. Before Christ died for our sins, the names for these two places, as they appear in Hebrew literature, translate to Abraham's bosom and the place of torments. Abraham's bosom was the place for the righteous dead. The place of torments was the place for those who died in their sins without righteousness. those who followed the Torah, who sought proper atonement by means of the sacrificial system when they sinned, who trusted the God of Israel, they went to Abraham's bosom, a kind of holding place of the righteous dead, until something else occurred. Something else that would release them to go and be free in a permanent state of liberty and safety. But it seems that the only safety their souls had in Abraham's bosom came at the price of being held captive. Held captive there, even if it was a relatively pleasant captivity. There were a couple of caveats, though, and in the name of time, I'll not go back to elsewhere in the Bible. Everywhere in the Bible this is quoted. I've covered this before, so you can just review it on your own. But there were two main categories of sin as defined in the Torah. Unintentional, sometimes called inadvertent sins, and intentional sins. Those terms do not necessarily mean accidental sins and on-purpose sins. Kind of like it sounds. It means something nearer to lesser sins and greater sins, and more to the point, sins that were forgivable, sins that could be atoned for, and sins that were unforgivable, sins that could not be atoned for. The unforgivable sins were few. And there was another idiom used for this category of sins called high-handed sins. The New Testament labels the unforgivable sin as blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, a subject we're not going to debate today. Now here's the thing to understand. The sacrificial system only had the ability to atone for the unintentional or the lesser or forgivable sins, whichever of those terms you prefer. Therefore, certain sins had no atonement available. And one of these unforgivable, no sacrifice available sins was murder, unjustifiable killing of a human being. Now, if a person committed an unintentional, and therefore a forgivable sin, they could repent in their hearts and then follow the Levitical procedures, offering the proper sacrifice, and they would be forgiven. When they died sometime later, then they were held righteous in God's eyes. But if they committed an intentional, therefore, an unforgivable sin, then there was no ritual procedure that could atone for them, and they died in an unrighteous state. So the spirit and the soul of the former went to Abraham's bosom, of the latter went to the place of torments. Now, when Christ died, we're told in Ephesians chapter 4 that he went up. But before he went up, he went down. In the Gospel of Luke, we get the story of Abraham's bosom and the place of torments that centers on a character named Lazarus. And we're told that when Jesus went down, he presented the good news and set the captives free, captives that were essentially being warehoused there. And because of his death as the Son of God, as our Messiah, Yeshua's blood atoned for the sin natures of the captives of Abraham's bosom, and Christ's living water, hit that attribute, cleansed them so thoroughly from their impurity that they were now able to go and be in the presence of God in heaven. Now look at the parallels of that with the laws and the purpose for the cities of refuge. A person who committed a forgivable, that is an unintentional sin, manslaughter, races to a place where he is held safe from being destroyed. However, there is a judge there that determines if the killing that this person is responsible for is murder or not. If it is murder, which is an unforgivable sin, he's turned away. He's not allowed into the sanctuary city. If it's not murder, but instead is manslaughter, an accidental killing, it's a forgivable sin, and he's let in. Atonement is made for him, and he is forgiven. But he has to remain captive there in that sanctuary city indefinitely if he wants to remain protected and safe. The reason the person raced to this city of refuge in the first place was because the kinsman redeemer, the blood avenger of the victim who the perpetrator had killed, that blood avenger had the legal right to take the life of that perpetrator in retribution, even if the killing was accidental. To be clear, the Levitical city of refuge provided the only place that was off limits to that blood avenger. The only place. If the perpetrator ever ventured outside of the city of refuge, he became fair game. Yet there is a strange, unexplained provision in all of this. Once the high priest of Israel dies, then that perpetrator can leave the city of refuge, and the blood avenger may no longer legally kill him. Strange. In fact, if the blood avenger did now take revenge, under those circumstances, he would have committed murder, an unforgivable sin. Well, what does the high priest dying have to do with anything? Why is the perpetrator of manslaughter let off the hook? Because the high priest passes away. There's been lots of commentary among the Hebrew sages and rabbis about this subject. And while there's no universal agreement, there's rarely much agreement on anything among all the rabbis and sages, the majority would agree that there is some mysterious, unspoken kind of atonement that happens as a result of the high priest's death, as illogical and undefined as it may seem. Now, let's compare this, all about the cities of sanctuary, the high priest's death, and so on, to Abraham's bosom and to Yeshua. A man commits forgivable sins, and at death, his soul races to the safety of Abraham's bosom. He is more or less a prisoner there until something or someone releases him to complete safety and full forgiveness where the victim's blood avenger can't destroy him. It was later in biblical times that the concept of Abraham's bosom was developed. And in those days, they really didn't know what that release mechanism was that freed the captives from Abraham's bosom. But we do now. Yeshua is called our high priest. And when our high priest died on the cross, one of the first things he did, we're told in Ephesians 4, is he went down to Abraham's bosom and told the captives, they're no longer prisoners in that place of refuge. They were no longer captives in an intermediate place. They could now go home. They could go to heaven, as it turns out, without fear of retribution from the blood avenger. The cities of refuge, you see, were a picture and a physical demonstration of the spiritual principle of Abraham's bosom and of Messiah and of heaven. And it shows that if we die in our unrighteousness, well, then we're already judged. It shows that if we die in our unrighteousness, we're already judged. It's over. The evil one has been given permission to possess those who sin, except for those who sin and seek atonement in the Lord. But it took the death of our high priest to make the ultimate safe destination open to mankind. there was a kind of righteousness that these saints of old, pre-Christ, pre-Yeshua held, that came from their trusting and obedience to God's laws. But of itself, it was not sufficient to allow them to stand before God in his heavenly realm. It took another kind of righteousness, a much higher, a humanly unachievable kind of righteousness, Yeshua's righteousness, for that to occur. The saints of old then had to go through a sort of two-step process, if you would. They had to trust God and obey the Torah, and upon their death, they were then quickly ushered to a safe place away from Satan's clutches. But this place was not heaven, because something else had to happen for that to eventually become possible: the death of their and our spiritual high priest, the Messiah, Yeshua. Today, it's a one-step process. It's only been available now to mankind for about 2,000 years. It's only been available since the crucifixion of Christ. Absent from the body, present with the Lord. Abraham's bosom is out of business. It's empty. He'll never again be occupied because it's no longer needed for its purpose as a city of refuge, as a temporary sanctuary, a place of refuge. But that place of torments, that's a whole nother matter. From there, there's no escape. There's no hope. Die in your unrighteousness, there's no middle ground. There's no second chance. No one goes to the place of torments and gets redeemed from there. As the story of Lazarus so greatly demonstrates. Since the coming of Christ, the only acceptable righteousness is the righteousness that he provides us. It's his righteousness that we do not attain. We simply put it on and wear it like a garment. It's a holy garment. It's given to us as a gift from the merciful hand of the King of the universe. I think that's enough to chew on today. We'll continue with this next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.